This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll share some memories of famed civil rights attorney Leonard Weinglass.
We mourn the death of this extraordinary progressive lawyer. From the streets of Newark to the Chicago 8 to the Ellsberg case and to the Cuban Five, Len is a lawyer we all cherished.
We'll talk with one of the leading attorneys trying to track down those in power accountable for war crimes.
We call this universal jurisdiction, but another word is nowhere to hide. Wolfgang Kolick has brought cases against the Argentinian junta, corporations involved in the dictatorship in Argentina, the Bush torture team, and others in the courts of the world.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We've had Len Weinglass on the show a number of times, particularly talking about the Cuban Five. Sadly, a couple of weeks ago, Len died. And I know, Michael, you were very involved as one of the caretakers. We've all been involved with Len as lawyers and legal people, but you really spent the last couple of months on and off at the hospital with Kathy Boudin and your wife, Debbie Smith, really caring for Len in his last days. And it's a very sad death, and of course it's one that for progressive lawyers is very, very significant.
Linda Bakiel was there too, as well as his nephew Scott Franzblau. Len got sick, and 2 months later he was gone. But I wanted to share some stories about Len, and I know that you two have some too. Len got out of Yale Law School in 1958, and in those days you had to join the military. I mean, unless you had some excuse, like you had a family, you had to go into the military. So he went into the Air Force, got to be a captain, was in the Judge Advocate General's Corps. He was a lawyer in the Air Force. And he made the mistake of too vigorously and successfully defending a black guy in some criminal charge, and the brass went nuts.
That was down in Texas, right?
Yeah, and they transferred him to Iceland. Why Iceland? Iceland has the purest gene pool of any country in the world. Drug companies test drugs in Iceland, and the Icelandic government cut a deal with the American military that the military would never send a black soldier to Iceland.
Isn't that amazing? It was part of the treaty, I think, with the United States in the late 50s.
So they knew that Len couldn't be a troublemaker representing black GIs in Iceland because there weren't any. And they sent him to Iceland, and he literally cooled his heels for a couple of years, but he learned Icelandic. He did something that really was unheard of at the time. He moved to Newark, which wasn't far from Belleville, where he was born, a little town in New Jersey, moved to Newark and set up a one-man office and represented defendants in criminal cases and represented black people in police abuse cases.
What year was that, Michael?
This is in 58.
So think about it. I mean, this is before all of the 60s.
Before
stuff.
Gibson, right. The first black mayor. It was a racist place, Newark.
Exactly. And so it was a very unusual, especially for a guy from Yale Law School going into the heart of Newark.
But you know, Michael and Heidi, that's what Len did his whole 50 years of practicing law.
I was going to ask, what was his first political case?
Well, the Chicago case was the one that he was most
famous in.
Well,
the big political case, but all the cases in Newark were political. The Newark riots, as Michael
said. Newark riots in the mid-60s, that's where he met Tom Hayden, defended Hayden, and then later on moved to defend Hayden in Chicago in the Chicago 8 case. And Michael, you had a little role
to play
in that.
I'm sure our listeners are familiar with Chicago 8. That was the attempt to indict initially 8 people, including Bobby Seale, for their protests at the Democratic National Convention in 1968. They had been indicted under the law known as the Rapp-Brown Law, Rapp-Brown Act, which prohibited crossing state lines for the purposes of causing a riot. And of course, it was a police riot, not a riot by the protesters. And there were 8 defendants originally. Bobby Seale eventually was dropped because he couldn't have his own lawyer, but not before he was strapped to a chair with a gag around his mouth. It was one of the horrendous American scenes of, you know, from slavery to being strapped into a chair with a gag in your mouth. Anyway, Len was the co-counsel with Bill Kunstler at that trial. Bill became also extremely famous from that trial. Len, well known, but less so. Len was the younger lawyer, and Len always described himself as the other lawyer in the Chicago 8 case or Chicago 7 case. So it is what did bring him into a certain amount of repute, but He was the other lawyer.
And wasn't he held in criminal contempt by the judge during that case?
Oh, yeah. In fact, Michael worked on the brief.
When I came to the center, those were the cases we were working on. The appeals of the Chicago 8, they actually got 5 years on one charge. The convictions were reversed. Bill Kunstler got a 4.5-year sentence for contempt. And Lenny, I think, got about a 2-year sentence. Yeah. All of the jail sentences were wiped out. Bill was held finally in one count of contempt but didn't go to jail.
And was that for speaking back to the judge?
Let's put it this way. It was a 3-ring circus, Heidi. So it was everything from, you know, Jerry Rubin would stand on his head on the counsel table. Bill would tease the judge. There's a famous scene about teasing him on marijuana. Lenny was a much less flamboyant, I think, but steady and managed to get held in contempt himself, and it would be for like not obeying the judge's order, for not listening to the judge, for talking back to the judge.
Anyway, he went on to defend really impossible cases that he would win, and defend some which lasted many years. Kathy Boudin's case lasted 23 years. The Palestinian 8 case out in L.A. lasted 20 years.
We call it the LL8. It was number of Palestinians who were going to be deported because of their First Amendment activities on behalf of Palestinians. The center, Lenny, David Cole, Mark Vanderhout, a number of Guild and center people along with Lenny were the key lawyers in that case. And the judge always in that case wanted to know if Lenny was going to come because there were many different hearings, 20, 30, who knows how many. But Lenny was the big star as well as obviously the most skilled lawyer. And of course, the judge always wanted to have Lenny in the courtroom.
The judge liked him. Right. He was Lenny's agent. He always would ask after him. But then he went on, another famous case is the Mumia case, which you know about, Heidi.
Well, when I came to the Guild in 99, Len was lead counsel for Mumia Abu-Jamal, and I remember actually, while he was working on Mumia's case, and he enlisted several Guild law students to help in digesting the massive volumes of cases, and also speaking really beautifully about Mumia's case. That was something that I think distinguished him from the many lawyers that have represented Mumia over the years, is that Len could really articulate both the procedural history and the political history of the case to masses.
There's a video I saw where he does 23 reasons why the trial was illegal and all this kind of stuff and why it didn't make sense, and it was incredible. I mean, right. It's a one-hour video. It's like
powerful stuff. But I remember I first met Len through you, Michael. You actually invited us to have breakfast at the World Trade Center, and we did an interview with Len on Kathy Boudin when she was up for parole.
That's
around
right.
2000.
That's right. She had decided that it was time to try to bring her plight to the attention of the wider public. And Len, of course, had represented her from the beginning along with Linda Bakiel. We did that interview. I forgot that it was up on top of the World Trade Center in blessed memory. And it came out as the front page article in the Guild newspaper.
That's right, Guild Notes. Yeah. And Lynn and Kathy wrote a lovely letter after we did that.
Well, he was working, of course, on the Cuban Five case. Len took generally one big case at a time, and he dove into them completely. It was his whole life. And he would know every document in the case cold. I mean, the Cuban Five case, thousands of documents. He was the key person with knowledge and the key strategist for the Cuban Five. Absolute key.
He came in at the appellate level, remember?
Right. I should say that.
Prison.
Yeah. Right. Lenny thinks, had that not happened, I mean, he thought that there might have been a different result. Of course, we'll never know that.
I think so, too.
But Len came in late, in terms of they had already been convicted, but he struggled for 5 years with that case, and it was still his key case at the end of his life. He went down to Cuba to consult on that case when he was already feeling quite ill. And he went down there, and then he came back, and then he went into the hospital. But it was so important to him that he went to Cuba when he was ill. He would come back a week or two before from California from visiting one of the Cuban Five, Gerardo, in prison. And it was the most meaningful case at this point in his life. But that's the way he worked. And it was incredible. And the last case that I went with him on was we went to Europe to meet Julian Assange from WikiLeaks, because Lenny was interested in that case. And we met with Julian for an entire day. And I know that people were extremely impressed with Lenny's tactical and political skills at thinking about a case like the WikiLeaks case, or any other case. Unfortunately, Lenny is not here with us to continue giving us that strategic and political help. One thing that's interesting, you know, Lenny fits a certain age generation. Lenny was 77. Michael and I are in our mid-60s. Heidi's in her mid-80s? No. I mean 40s.
Heidi's younger.
And there's very few political left lawyers from Lenny's generation. Lenny got out of law school, think about it, mid-50s, a time of heavy anti-communism in this country. The Guild had been decimated, and very few lawyers went into political law. And Lenny is really both the first and the last almost of a particular generation during that period.
You know, I thought about why. He came from a small Jewish community of 200 families in Belleville, New Jersey. His father had difficulties during the Depression, lost his business, and then his house was foreclosed on. The family had to go live with relatives. His grandfather, who was the head of the congregation, and who led services at the synagogue, lost his business and actually committed suicide. It must have been coupled with the anti-Semitism in those days, which was very real, and this hermetic Jewish community, and then getting shaken back and forth by those tragedies, must have given him a real kind of outsider's view of the world. One story his sister told me about when he graduated high school. He's vice president of his high school class. He was a star end on the football team. He was an extraordinary student. You can imagine him. He got a scholarship to college, and then he was so good he got into Yale for law school. But when he graduated high school, he wanted to see the country. And he told his dad, take me to the corner of the highway. I'm going to hitchhike to California. And he took out of his pocket all his identification, because he was afraid the outside world was anti-Semitic. They would find out his name was Weinglass, that he was Jewish, and he'd be in trouble. So he stood on the corner with no ID, stuck his thumb out. His father waved goodbye and was crying, and Len got a ride from an 18-wheeler, and he was off, and he wrote back to his parents, everybody's been really nice to me. They buy me lunch and dinner, and I got all the way out to California. Well, he got out there, and he got a job at a truck farm doing stoop agricultural labor with Japanese field workers. And one night, one of the field workers was murdered. And Len thought, you know, I'm out here with no ID. I could be in trouble. And in the middle of the night, he jumped over the fence and fled and got his way back to New Jersey.
Amazing. One of the things that was unusual about Len is that he was a very modest man. And unlike some of the great trial attorneys, political attorneys who have huge egos and a boisterous demeanor to accompany that, I know that we've honored Len in the Guild a few times, and he was very humble.
Very humble and very sweet.
Very humble and very sweet, but he was also very self-confident. Don't want to mistake modesty and sweetness for the fact that he did think when he got into a case that he could always do an incredible job.
And you know what? He was right. He may not have been detached, but he was objective, and he was right. I think one story that his sister Elaine told me is an indication of his character. They used to pal around with a little kid. They were both 9 years old, and they were inseparable. And one day they got into a huge fight, and Len came back home with a big black eye. It looked terrible. And his father said, what happened to you? And Len said, well, I was in a fight with Johnny. And the father said, yeah, but you know, you must have really done something to him. And Len said, no, I didn't do anything to him. And the father said, why? And Len said, because he's my friend.
We could talk about Lenny for a very long time. We'll have a memorial service for him hopefully in the next couple of months. In May sometime. And let's close this little section on Lenny by reading a couple of the tributes that poured into Lenny from his clients, and then a beautiful poem that was written by one of his co-counsel.
I have a letter from one of the Cuban Five, Antonio Guerrero, that came to Lenny in the hospital. Lenny died on March 23rd, and this came to him a week before he passed away. It accompanied a watercolor that Tony had sent. And here's the letter. Dear Len, it will be a short note accompanying an artwork that I am sending you. Lately, I've been doing many watercolor paintings, most of them of flowers, taking photo reference from a book. I decided to send you this green goddess lily, a simple but a beautiful flower. And I like it because it's green, a color that represents hope. So this flower, I could say, represents you, Len, a man of great hopes and a man who has struggled all his life for the best hopes for humanity, justice, peace, and solidarity. I want you to know that we think of you every single day, that we have confidence in your recovery, and that we love you immensely. And when I say we, I mean not only the five in our families, but I mean all the Cuban people and all the friends around the world. Take care. Be strong. Vence Ramos. A big hug, Antonio Guerrero.
And I think it's worth noting that indeed the Cubans hold up the Cuban Five as heroes, and they also held Len in the absolute highest esteem because of his dedication toward freeing and getting justice for the Cuban Five.
What they did after Len's death, I got a flyer in the mail that was sent out all over the world, I guess, and it said, El Último Adios, the last goodbye to Len, and it was held, a celebration or a celebration of his life was held at the at ECAP, which is the in Havana, the Friendship Association with the peoples around the world, and there was a memorial book set up inside the building. And the Cubans told me that the lines were around the block in Havana to sign Len's memorial book. He was such a hero in Cuba for taking on with such incredible effort and work the case of the Cuban Five. Now, the poem you just read, Michael, was by one of the Cuban Five.
Yeah, Antonio Guerrero. And then there's a letter that I would hope you could read, Michael, by Gerardo Hernandez, another one of the Cuban Five. Gerardo is doing two life sentences. Antonio, I think, got 17 years. The last piece of legal work that Len did, and we have a photograph of him reading a brief in his hospital bed, was a habeas writ for Antonio and Gerardo, saying that the United States government paid journalists to write BS articles in the Miami Press while the jury was meeting to discuss their fate. So they tried to rig the trial, and the habeas writ is trying to get him out because of the improper conduct of the government.
But Gerardo posted this letter. It begins, in memory of Leonard Wineglass. Not that long ago, Len came to visit me, and we worked for several hours preparing for the next step of my appeal. I noticed at the time that he was tired. I was worried with his advanced age that he was driving alone after a long trip from New York. The weather was bad, and the roads from the airport up to Victorville wind through the mountains surrounding the high desert. I mentioned my concern to him, but he did not pay it attention. That was the way he was. Nothing stopped him. When we would meet, the same thing would always happen. At some point in our conversation, while listening to him talk, my mind would separate from the words and I would focus on the person. I would realize that here is this great man, the tremendous lawyer, the legendary fighter for justice, right here in front of me. I told him that I had seen images of him in documentaries on TV, dedicating himself to important legal cases that he had participated in from a very young age. With pride, I would tell people watching, that is the lawyer of the five. It did not matter how much I read or heard about Len, I knew through his humility and modesty that there was a lot I still had to discover about this man who had dedicated his life to his profession. Len always insisted that our case, like the others that he had dedicated lots of his time to, was essentially a political one. He cautioned us from the start that this struggle would be long and difficult. His experience with the system had taught him that. For our part, beyond the professional relationship we had, we always thought of him as one compañero in the battle for justice. Len leaves us at an important moment, but he leaves us prepared to carry on the path. On more than one occasion, he expressed his admiration and respect for the other lawyers on our legal team, and I think that he has left confident that our case is in good hands. Like other people who during these years have accompanied us in our struggle to make justice prevail, he will not be with us to see the inevitable triumph. We are confident that day will arrive, and to Len and to all the others, we will pay them a well-deserved tribute in our homeland. On behalf of the Cuban Five and our families, and from the millions of Cubans and brothers and sisters from all over the world who trusted and admired him, we send our most sincere condolences to Len's family and friends. Gerardo Hernandez, Victorville, California, March 23rd, 2011. That's the prison that Gerardo is in.
Michael, what did you think of the recent Obama speech on Libya?
Well, the best way, in a very short way to talk about it, is the New York Times did a comparison of Bush's statements to Obama's statements. They titled the piece, Echoes of Bush and Obama's Libya Speech. But, you know, you could just, they do about six comparisons. They have Bush, Obama, Bush, Obama. You could say Obama, Bush, Obama, Bush. So there's much that's like Bush. I'll just read you one clause, and then we'll have a little comment on that. Bush: our country has accepted obligations that are difficult to fulfill and would be dishonorable to abandon. Yet because we have acted in the great liberating tradition of this nation, tens of millions have achieved their freedom. And as hope kindles hope, millions more will find it. That's Bush. Now let's hear Obama. For generations, the United States of America has played a unique role as an anchor of global security and as an advocate for human rights. Mindful of the risks and costs of military action, we are naturally reluctant to use force to solve the world's many challenges. But when our interests and values are at stake, we have a responsibility to act. So there you have it. Bush and Obama, the great liberating tradition of this country. And of course, we can just sit here and go from A to Z and name all the countries they've been successful in liberating. Oh, Vietnam, all of the countries in Central America, Nicaragua, Grenada, El Salvador, the coup in Venezuela, the war in Iraq, Afghanistan and Pakistan, and now Libya. So what do we have here? It always reminds me of the end of Animal Farm, and I don't have the exact language, but remember how the animals take over, and from the cruel humans, I think, is that what happens, right? And as they looked from human to animal, from animal to human, they all looked the same. So there you have Obama, Bush. Now, I did write, and people can read, I wrote something on the legality of the war on Huffington Post. You can go there under my name, and we'll link to it. It's called To Hell with the Constitution, Obama Goes to War. And, of course, I say in there, and it's obvious, Obama didn't get the Congress's authority to go to this war, and we talked about that last week. And I say that some people say it makes no difference at all. They would have approved it anyway. But I said, well, maybe we would have had some questions. Maybe they would have said, why Libya and not the Ivory Coast, where thousands are being murdered and about a million people have fled from the capital and are refugees? Why Libya and not Israel when it was killing 1,400 Palestinians in Gaza? And I say, was this really a war about saving lives or was it about oil? Why is the African Union not supporting the war? Is this war really about regime change? Finally, are not three wars in the Middle East and Central Asia three too many? You can read the whole article on Huffington Post. A few days ago, New York City, and really throughout the United States, as well as the labor movement, remembered the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. The fire took place on March 25th, 1911. It spread through the 7th, 8th, and 9th floors of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory in New York City's Greenwich Village. The mostly immigrant workers, young Italian, Jewish, and German women who sewed shirtwaists or women's blouses, were trapped behind locked doors. The death toll was 146, and many women, their clothing and hair burning, threw themselves from the windows to their deaths on the pavement far below, while spectators watched and could not help. Shortly thereafter, 20,000 women struck for improved working conditions and wages. The factory building is now part of NYU, New York University. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire remains the fourth largest industrial disaster in United States history. A few days ago, I walked over to the building, and there were many, many memorial services and remembrances of the fire throughout New York and probably throughout the country. In front of the building, which is right near where I live, it's on Washington Place and Green Street, there were hundreds of bouquets of flowers. There were chalk names of the women who died with their ages. There were lists of the names. And if you looked up to the 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th floors, there were black flags decked out of windows for the women who died. One of the interesting projects is people had forgotten the fire for a long time until this 100th anniversary. A couple of people went and they tried to get the names of all 146 people, which have only finally been identified this year. And what someone did, they took chalk and they went to each of the women's houses in the East Village, in the Lower East Side, wherever they lived, mostly down there. In front of their houses, they chalked the woman's name with her age and, of course, their death from the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. An incredibly moving memorial to those many, many people who died. We remember the women who died in the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, and Heidi will read us a poem by Marge Piercy.
Bodies falling through the air when all exits from the fire are closed to them and flames lick their skin. We have seen that in our time and theirs. Labor was cheap then, too often cheap now. Sweatshops, whether crammed into Brooklyn lofts or shipped overseas. Women are cheap, and children are cheaper. Doors locked against their escape. Growing up in Center City, Detroit, when the factories hummed like huge hives at night and the sky was pink from steel mills on the river, I learned early how replaceable we all were to those with power to replace us. I see your charred clothes glued to flesh as you hurtle toward pavement, my sisters, hard-worked women with blistered hands, forced to labor 6 days, whose rest came only in histories that can never rectify what greed ignited.
Well, Michael, we're coming upon two significant anniversaries with respect to Martin Luther King.
Thank you for raising that, Michael. This is, of course, the week of, and it's April 4th, 1968, where Martin Luther King was murdered in Memphis after, interestingly, being there to support sanitation workers who were on a strike. So that's 1968. And a year before that, to the exact date, April 4th, 1967, Martin Luther King gave his incredibly important speech against the war in Vietnam at the Riverside Cathedral in New York City, a year before he's murdered. And that speech, which I would recommend everyone to listen to or read, is one of the most extraordinary talks he ever made. And if you want to talk about Martin Luther King being a radical, an anti-militarist, read that speech, as well as, you know, people have claimed he was a socialist. He comes close in that speech. The speech is called Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence. I read it or listen to it every year, and it makes you miss Martin Luther King incredibly, particularly now as we have a president who also won the Nobel Peace Prize. Of course, Martin Luther King did. He won the Nobel Peace Prize, and then, of course, President Obama won it. And just look at the differences. I mean, if he had to give a speech today, King would have to say, beyond Libya, Israel, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And you have a president who won the Nobel Peace Prize who has involved the United States and kept going 4 or 5, you can count the number of wars. If you want to hear or read that extraordinary Beyond Vietnam speech by Martin Luther King, go to our website, lawanddisorder.org, and the link for the King speech will be up.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Today we speak with attorney Wolfgang Kolick from Berlin, Germany. Wolfgang is a human rights attorney and general secretary for the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, a litigation organization modeled on the Center for Constitutional Rights. Wolfgang will address specifically universal jurisdiction cases. Those cases concern fundamental violations of human rights that can be brought in any court in the world and are usually done when the home courts, for example in Argentina or the United States, refuse to investigate and prosecute serious violations of human rights. Wolfgang was the lead attorney in the cases in Germany against the Argentina junta leaders, in Argentina itself against various corporations who supported the dirty war in the 80s, as well as cases brought in Spain against the Bush torture team. Wolfgang considers these cases essential if we are to ever have powerful leaders and corporations brought to justice. He says it's not easy work, it's difficult, because generally, courts shy away from going after big corporations and the leaders of major countries. But it's work that Wolfgang says must be done.
Wolfgang Kolick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Now, Wolfgang, you're a lawyer in Germany and you practice criminal law, but you've also done a great deal with international justice, international criminal justice in particular. And let's start from where you sort of started from, which is South America, dirty wars in South America, Argentina in particular. First, tell us what brought you into looking at Argentina at all.
Yeah, as you have said, I have the privilege to work on behalf of German-Argentinian victims of the dirty war between 76 and 83 in Argentina. As you all know, the Argentinian cases and the Chilean cases were like the most important phase in universal jurisdiction, end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s. We filed cases in Germany, in Italy, in France, in Spain, of course. Spain was the most important country. The idea of the Chilean and the Argentinian cases in European courts was not to trial Argentinians and Chileans in Europe, but to impulse accountability in Chile and in Argentina. That's what people call the Videla effect or the Pinochet effect. It means that it helped the human rights movement in Argentina and in Chile to overcome impunity in their countries. And that somehow worked. And it worked for two reasons. One reason was a very vivid civil society. So it was the civil society in Argentina which demanded over nearly 20 years the justice and investigation and prosecution of the dirty war crimes. And the second characteristic of the Argentinian case was that they exhausted all remedies, from local remedies, national remedies, regional remedies, Inter-American Court.
In Argentina, they exhausted all remedies.
In Argentina, at the Inter-American Court, then they went to Europe. It all had the ultimate goal to initiate trials in Argentina, and that's what happens now since 2005, 2006, when the amnesty laws were abolished by the government of Néstor Kirchner. A huge wave of investigations began, and now we have like 150 judgments, especially of the higher ups of former President Videla and other leaders of the military, had been sentenced to life sentence. But there is no end to be seen. If you go to Buenos Aires by this time, you will be able to observe junta trials from Monday till Friday. And you will see police officers, you will see military officers, you will see torturers, guards, but you will also see military leaders. And moreover, at this point, special prosecutors and also parts of the civil society are demanding the investigation and the prosecution of crimes committed by corporations who added and abetted the dictatorship or who profited from the dictatorship.
Let me step back a second before we go to corporations in Argentina. So what happened in Argentina is after the dirty war, there were no prosecutions. There were sort of amnesties or forgiveness.
So the history was that 30,000 people disappear, 100,000 were tortured. But at the same time, during the dictatorship, the Madres de Plaza de Mayo already demanded some kind of justice. And the lawyers started with their habeas corpus complaints, started to build up a record to hold, to keep some evidence, which then later was used in the trials after the in the democracy. In 85, 86, already a very important series of trials took place, the famous trial of the junta, where they were already sentenced, and then the amnesty laws were established, a series of amnesty laws, which led to the situation which is very common in all over Latin America, the situation of impunity. As I said, the human rights movement in Argentina was so strong that they maintained a certain presence and a certain public attention, although none of the political parties was really in favor of more prosecution.
So we understand that in Argentina, but then there was a role that you played and others played in Europe that eventually, as you said, pushed the Argentinians into their own prosecutions. But can you tell us about that? I know you brought cases in Germany. In fact, you got extradition against some Argentinian generals. There's at least there was one Argentinian guy serving, maybe still is, a sentence in Spain, I think. Mm-hmm. So why don't you talk about that a little bit and then go back to Argentina?
For all of us, Argentina is something like the blueprint. That's the kind of case and cooperation with the human rights movement from the global south we want to repeat. We want to repeat in other cases. It went so well because there was a certain Argentinian presence in Europe. There were exile communities in many countries, and there were citizens of many European countries, victims of the dictatorship. So this allowed us to bring cases first in Italy and in France, and then in Spain and in Germany. The most important judicial decisions were judgments in absentia in France and in Italy, which are always a little bit doubtful because
absentia. Without the defendants,
being there. So this is, in terms of a fair trial, not the best thing you can imagine as a human rights person. So what was important was, on one hand, a series of 100 arrest warrants in Spain released by Baltasar Garzón, who was by that time the investigation judge in charge. And what we achieved in Germany was a handful of international arrest warrants, amongst them an arrest warrant against former President Videla. And that arrest warrant resulted also in an extradition warrant by the German government. And that somehow helped to build up an atmosphere of pressure. It helped the Argentinian president by that time, Néstor Kirchner, to convince the judges and the politicians to say, look, it's better if we do it than the Europeans continue with their trials. So better we should do it. And that's what happened then. And so this is what we are hoping and what we are working for in other situations. Because obviously the Pinochet and the Argentinian cases were successful. They inspired the human rights movement, not only in Europe, but also in other countries. And so what we tried then is we tried to transfer this Argentinian and Chilean experiences to other situations. So there were serious...
I want to move you back to corporate complicity in the Argentinian dirty war. And you sued and are involved in suits not just against the leadership of the dirty war, but corporate complicity. And so just give us a little piece of that.
Yeah, for us, it was from the very beginning, especially in Germany, it was very important not to point out only to old military torturers and leaders who were no more in power, but we also wanted to talk about complicity of Western actors. So we did two things. One thing was we tried to get access to the files of the German Foreign Ministry and of possible complicity of German foreign politicians. There was one thing. And the second thing is I filed at some point a case against Mercy Dispense, because at the plant of Mercy Dispense in the province of Buenos Aires, 15 trade unionists were disappeared.
You filed that case in Germany?
We filed the case in Germany as a criminal case against a German-Argentinian manager, Juan Tasselkraut, who had the double citizenship, which allowed us to bring the case in Germany. Then we filed a case in the U.S., an Alien Tort Claims Act case in the U.S., which is still pending. Yeah, we filed a case in Argentina, which is also still pending, against Mercy Dispense, by then now Daimler. And so the importance of this case is, of course, let's say one line in the human rights movement is to blame the torturers and only the torturers and the military leaders. We want to talk about the reasons why these human rights violations have been committed, why the Argentinian militaries took the decision to oppress their population, and our explanation is they wanted to install political and economical system which needed the extermination of the trade unionists. And that's one of the most important facts to know, that the main bulk of the disappeared have been workers and trade unionists. So
it's not just about political powers, what you're
saying. It's not about political power.
It's about an economic transformation.
It's about an economic transformation. And Argentina still suffers from this economic transformation. For us, it's also important to use Obama's words, not to look backwards. It's not looking backwards. First of all, it's not looking backwards because the victims are still suffering. Everybody who has been tortured is still suffering, is still traumatized. The families of the disappeared, of the torturers, are still traumatized. So it's actually to do this work around accountability, to demand investigations, to demand prosecution, is trauma work. So this is one very important reason. It's not only trauma work for the tortured, for the disappeared, for their families, but also for a society which hasn't dealt with its past has some problems in the present and in the future. So that's one important reason to deal with these questions even 35 years afterwards. And the second set of reason is we have to understand what happened in the 70s to open up our minds what can be the future of the Argentinian society now. So it's going to be difficult to repeat history, but it's important to understand what the military system produced. It's important to understand the political and economic transformation in order to overcome it. So the trials give us the chance to open up the discussion again. And there are a lot of Argentinian actors who actually think of that. And that's for us, it's also so incredibly important that in Argentina, this accountability discussion, this accountability work, what happens in the courtroom is somehow transmitted to Argentinian society, is somehow discussed by Argentinian society. And so this is why we keep on going discussing Argentina, because it's such a good example, and it's worth to study this example to learn for other situations.
But our situation here, even in the U.S. and in the war. But I want to bring you now to you were trying to give a larger picture, because you had said that both the prosecutions in Chile as well as in Argentina were very significant for all of us, and not just the prosecutions, but what you're talking about with Argentina. And now, how are you trying to take that work forward now, and how are other people trying to do that?
Immediately after the Pinochet arrest in 1998, networks of lawyers from Europe, from the U.S., and from the South met and tried to bring other cases in order to make universal jurisdiction really universal. People tried to bring cases against Russian officials because of the crimes in Chechnya, and against Israeli officials because war crimes committed in Israel and in Palestine. But also, of course, that's what we tried in Europe, to bring cases because of CIA rendition and torture cases because of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. There, clearly, universal jurisdiction somehow showed its limits. That's so far. It was very difficult to bring cases against the powerful of the world. So it still rests the suspicion that the whole international criminal justice system is just another tool of the powerful against the powerless, which is not exactly the case, but it's still hard to justify a system which only goes after Yugoslavians and Africans. So this is why we, the human rights movement and lawyers, have to try to bring cases against the powerful, Russia, China, the US, or even Sri Lanka or Israel, who all do undertake all actions to avoid investigation and prosecution after the same standards Argentinians and Chileans had been tried.
I know one of the key cases you're working on right now has to do with U.S. officials in Spain. Can you just describe overall what you're doing in Spain? I know you're working both with ECCHR, your organization, CCR, my organization, as well as lawyers in Spain. But give us some sense of where the Spanish prosecution is right now.
Yeah, first of all, we started in 2004 to bring cases in Europe against U.S. officials. And we always said we don't know if our attempts are going to be successful in short term. We are ready for it. We brought comprehensive cases with lots of material, with lots of documentation. So we impulsed an important discussion also under European academics. And people are quite open to discuss the merits of the cases. But we always ended up in discussing jurisdictional questions. So this jurisdictional obstacles led to denial of the cases in Germany, later on in France. But we still try to bring cases wherever it makes sense and wherever we are able to overcome this purely jurisdictional obstacles. It seemed at some point that Spain might be the country where an investigation of the events of the torture system might be possible. That was by the time when Baltasar Garzón, the investigation judge, was in charge of the Guantanamo cases in Spain. Then he had to go because he's now under trial. But still, there are two sets of cases ongoing in Spain. We are pretty optimistic that some kind of investigation will be carried out in Spain. But some people are like over pessimistic, because even now we achieved that several former US officials, or from the CIA, or from the army, or politicians, cannot travel anymore without running the risk to be arrested. I give you one example, and that's the example of one CIA official who faces an arrest warrant in Germany because of the abduction of Khalid El-Masri, a German citizen who was rendered to Afghanistan, tortured there, and then went back to Germany. It's an arrest warrant, and so many people would say, what, nothing happens? Yes, she wanted to go to London. She couldn't, because the Brits said, look, you're welcome here, but if once you come to London, we have to enforce the German arrest warrant. And so we have a situation where many of the former officials don't know where and what they're facing. I'm not satisfied with that.
It's a pretty big step.
It's a pretty big step, because 10 years before, no one would have expected that. No one would have expected an Italian or a German court release arrest warrant against CIA officials. And no one would have expected that the agency or the Pentagon has to advise his officials not to go in certain countries, and I'm talking about European countries. I talk about important European allies where they're facing prosecution, although everybody in charge did everything to avoid this kind of prosecution. So we achieved something. We achieved something recently. I'm also not satisfied about it, but still it's more than we thought it's possible. You know that former President Bush wanted to go to Switzerland and finally didn't go because he got aware of the fact that we are filing a case there because of his own statements regarding torture. And so This is more than than we achieved in any other situation of torture and war crimes in the after the Second World War. The U.S. was involved in many, many international crimes. Latin America, Central America, Vietnam. But in none of these cases, there was a real danger for a former U.S. president to be prosecuted in a European country. Now there is a danger, and that's due to our work. As again, I'm not satisfied, and I know that we always can do more, but it's also an argument against those cynical people who always would say that nothing is possible. Yes, there is something possible. Yes, we can do something. Yes, it has always to be more. But somehow it makes a sense from what we learned in the last in the past 5 years.
If you compare it to what was thought about after the Second World War till today, it's a huge gain to be able to have done this and actually have the idea that these courts are might hold U.S. officials responsible and arrest them. It's remarkable.
Yeah, but we still have to struggle to maintain this status, because the whole international criminal justice system is on stake, because the more and more powerful actors from the South, like from China, like from Russia, from India, from South Africa, they would come up with this question: why should we obey this international rules? You proved us 150 years that you're not willing to obey these rules. Why should we do now? And so it's not only about international criminal justice system, it's about the international law as such, that we have to make this laws applicable to all, and even to the powerful of our nations.
Thank you, Wolfgang Kallak. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.